first of all, I want to welcome everybody that's watching online today. Good morning, everybody. If you're watching now or later on, we welcome you. We celebrate you. Can we welcome everybody that is virtually here with us today? Come on, celebrate them today. Glad that you are here. If we've never met you, we'd love to see you at a 9 or a 10:30. If we haven't seen you in a while, we can't wait to see you again, but we are glad that you're with us in this respect. All right, here we go. Rhetorical question for you all. What would you do if you found out you were the most important person or the most powerful person in a room? Some of you are going, that's happening right now for you, right? What would you do if you knew that you were the most powerful person, the most important person in a room? I first came across this question through a sermon maybe 5-6 years ago, a handful of years ago. And it was an astounding question to me, and it was centered around a particular Bible moment. Let's see if you can remember this moment. There is an incredible story that speaks of where Jesus walks into the home of someone, and what should have happened is when he walked into that place as a guest of honor, you would put your sandals off to the side. Everything was open during that time, which is just creepy. I hate toes. Okay, so off to the side. And then you'd come in, and what would be customary would be is that there would be a foot washing. So in most of those homes, I remember seeing this in Israel last year, most homes during New Testament time where Jesus walked the planet, there are only two rooms that they would use. One was a smaller room, it was kind of a behind-the-scenes type of a room, and that's where all the cooking was. Sometimes the bedroom would be in that area, the bed, rather, would be in that area. Sometimes the bed would be in the more common area that was the living space. Most people only had two rooms unless they were people of great means. Everybody with me on that? So you'd see that. How many of you now, you need to be more content with where you live? What you live in? Just saying. So two rooms. Walk in, and then this common area, they will be received. So Jesus walks in as a guest with his disciples, and no one washes his feet. Host doesn't, nor do all his disciples wash his feet. Sits down to eat, and what happens is, as soon as he sits down to eat, then he gets up. And if you're there, you have to kind of wonder if he's going to get up to just storm out because he's offended. Is he going to scold them? What's he going to do? And he gets up to be able to serve them. And putting a towel around his waist, he grabs not just a towel, but he grabs a basin and begins to wash the feet of everybody that's there. So Jesus, knowing he's the most important person, the most powerful person in the room, he gets up to lower himself. He gets up to serve. Well, I've told you before throughout our series regarding Dream to Destiny, there are moments that remind me and others that have read these passages that Joseph in the Old Testament, go back a few thousand years before Jesus' time, there are moments that remind us of the way Jesus would function. Where we are going to go today in Genesis 42 is one of those moments. And it's astounding to me. I got all fired up in the first service, and I added more than I had even prepared, honestly, to that because I just got into the flow of what the passage was communicating, and it literally took me down a different path in one respect that I hadn't even prepared, which is ironic to me because in Genesis 42, have you ever heard of Martin Luther before? Martin Luther did the 95 Theses. He posted on the Wittenberg door. He goes against the regime of the Catholic Church during his day. He becomes the father of Protestantism back in the 1500s. What happens is Martin Luther, until his dying day, couldn't resolve Genesis 42. He didn't see value in it. And for me, I just keep seeing more and more value within it. And I hope you'll side with me and not with Luther this morning on Genesis 42. Let's dive into the flow of the passage. Are you all okay so far? You can either do, you all received this on your way in. You can follow along this way or on the app. Here's my suggestion for you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to read the passage off the screen, which I normally don't do. I'm going to read the passage through the screen and I'll stop middle of the narrative and then pull on each of these where you have the verse notation. Is everybody with me on that? So I'll do my best. I took too long in a couple of the turns, so I'll do my best to go a little bit quicker to establish better pace. So let's do it this way. Genesis 42 begins as such. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy the grain for us so that we may live and not die." Everybody remember the context of what's happening. What's the backdrop right now? They're in Egypt. Joseph has been utilized by Pharaoh, by God, to interpret a dream to help them understand and prepare for. You're going to have 7 years of plenty, and then it'll be followed by 7 years of famine. Very good. They are about a year in to that second seven. 7 years of prosperity, done. Joseph has guided them through. We're keeping a fifth of everything that is produced during the first 7 years so that we have prepared planned for adequately in abundance so that we will be able to live off of the seven next years. Everybody with me on that? Jacob lives in an area called Canaan. It's outside of Egypt. But they know Egypt's the only place that has the abundance. And ironically, it's because of Joseph's planning. So, 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. Keep going. But Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his other brothers, for he feared the harm might happen to him. Now, this is important, but I need to move fast through this. Benjamin is one of the sons. Does anybody remember how many sons there are in total? There are 12 in total. So, 12 sons in total. Minus one. Where is he? He's in Egypt. That's Joseph, right? So now we're down to 11. Then, Jacob doesn't want to send Benjamin. So we have 10 that are going to go. Everybody's with me on that, right? Why does Jacob want to hold Benjamin back? So I want you to think about this. Benjamin was born under unique circumstances. Benjamin is the 12th out of the birth order. Do you remember who number 11 was in the birth order? It's Joseph. Those two, number 11 and number 12, are the only children born through to, do you remember mom's name? Rachel. Very good. Rachel. Jacob married Rachel, and he fell in love with her, literally love at first sight. It's a great romantic story, actually. Jacob falls in love with Rachel, and what happens is when he falls in love with her, he asks for her hand in marriage through Rachel's dad, Laban. Laban says, absolutely. Married. The next morning, Rachel's not the one that's next to him when he wakes up. It's older sister, Leah. Remember that part of the story? And the Bible is less than complimentary regarding Leah. The Bible says that Leah had weak eyes and Rachel was lovely. Do you know what weak eyes means? She'd be ugly. In some Bibles, it has in parentheses, we mean ugly. She had weak eyes. And so Laban goes, this is my only shot to marry her off. She's the older daughter. She should have been married first anyway. And Jacob doesn't know it. And ironically, Jacob's name means deceiver. And now Laban pulls it on him. It's an incredible, incredible story in the late 20s of the first book of the Bible, book of Genesis. It's a great, great story. I highly recommend it. So that's for free. Okay. So what happens is, now Leah and Rachel are with Jacob. So Jacob has to work seven more years for Rachel to be his wife. And he now has two wives. Some of you guys think you got enough trouble. Okay, the two wives. You got the ugly one and the beautiful one. And Leah keeps having child after child after child. She has in order. She has Reuben. She has Levi. She has Simeon. She has Judah. She keeps having children. And every time she has them, she's hoping that God will see her and her husband will see her. Think about how sad this story is. She's just along for the ride. They pack up and they go, oh, you're coming too? Like it's not grand for poor Leah. You know, you're the one that has weak eyes. Just stay in that chapter. We're going. You're going. But she comes along. She feels the pain of that. But Rachel has another issue altogether. She's barren. And so she even offers maidservants to Jacob along the way. So they have children 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and still through even 10, Rachel has never offered a son. How many of you know that in that culture, that was an albatross of sorts? So finally, Rachel has Joseph. That one goes. Benjamin is born. Now, I don't know if you know this, but what happens during the pregnancy or the delivery of Benjamin? Do you know what happens to Rachel? She dies. In fact, as she's drawing her last breath, she names him Ben-Oni, not Obi-Wan Kenobi. Ben-Oni. She names him Ben-Oni, which means child of the pain or child of suffering. And she literally dies. As she's breathing her last, Jacob intervenes and he says, listen, I know it's pain. It's going to be pain for me because you're who I really loved. Because look at that one. Okay. You're just kidding. You're who I really loved. He was truly enamored with her. And so his heart is broken. But he says, no, that son will not be Ben-Oni, child of the pain. It'll be child of the father, child of the promise. So that son is born before, I believe, some scholars disagree on this. I believe Benjamin was born before Joseph goes away. So think about it from this perspective. When Joseph originally has his encounter with the brothers and he's sold into slavery, do you remember that there's no mention of mom? And if you look at it chronologically in two chapters before, it registers that Rachel had died. Not every part of the Bible reads chronologically, but more than likely this part does, where Rachel dies. So that means if Rachel is dead, that means who is alive? Benjamin. I'll get to a point at some point, I promise. By about 1:30, I will. So, Rachel dies, Benjamin is born. Now think with me on the timeline of what's happened so far with Joseph. He is 17 years old when he's sold into slavery. Then what happens? Then he is in prison and the like for 13 years. Finally promoted at 30. Then you remember what happens the next 7 years. Land of abundance, he leads them through. Now we're about another year in. So more than likely, Joseph is about 38 or 39 years old. And I misspoke on this in the first service. So let me do it this way. So at this point, what you have is, neither one of these sides work. There we go. That Joseph has been in Egypt for about 21, 22 years. 21 plus 17 is what? 38. He's 38. More than likely, Benjamin is at least then how old? This is the last part of the equation. More than likely, Benjamin is how old? He would be this number plus whatever difference we don't have privy, that we're not privy to. Everybody with me on that? Okay, so let's pretend he's 21 or 22 years old. That's college age. That's launching your career. That boy, Jacob, doesn't want to send him to go to Egypt. Because what has he done? He has projected the favoritism that was on Joseph before, put it onto Benjamin. He is now a child of the promise, a child of the father. Now he is born in the place of his wife's dying. And so you'll see it bear out later. He literally views Benjamin as the only son he has left. All the other guys, the other 10, are just part of the backdrop. They're part of the story, but they're not part of his heart. It's significant from that standpoint. He does not want to send Benjamin, and we'll come back to that, how that's significant, because, spoiler alert, Joseph wants to see him. So now, verse 5 says it this way, "Thus the sons of Israel come to buy among those that come, for the famine was in the land of Canaan." Verse 6, I have a wrong note here that says verse 5 is the bow down. It's actually verse 6. "Now Joseph was governor over the land, was with the one who said to all the people of the land, and Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him and their faces to the ground." This is inserted. It's just like the slip in. But how many of you know this is now the culmination of Joseph's dreams from the original dreaming that he had at 17 years old, 21 years ago. Joseph finally sees the culmination, and the writer just kind of just scoots over it, because you get this impression that Joseph, as he sees that the brothers are there, they're bowing before him. The dreams signify that. It will be sheaves bowing, sheaves of grain bowing before me, the sun, moon, and stars bowing before me. But Joseph didn't understand it. But here in this moment, it's incredibly practical that they bow down before him. Just in the way God had spoken to Joseph 21 years earlier. And look how he messes with his brothers. Continuing. Verse 7, Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them. But he treated them like strangers and spoke harshly to them. "Where do you come from?" "From the land of Canaan to buy food." Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Notice how the writer communicates that with redundancy. Continuing. Then Joseph remembered the dreams he dreamed of them. Now, let's go back for a moment. How many of you remember that Joseph, in the previous chapter, we see the moment where Joseph has two sons. Let me remember that. Named Manasseh, which means the Lord caused me to forget, and Ephraim, which means the Lord caused me to be, can you help me? Fruitful. You need to be able to forget your pain before you can be fruitful. It's in that order. Here, Joseph had never really forgotten, but he had forgotten the pain. Now he remembers his dreams because he sees them. He recognizes them, they don't recognize him. He sees them, and he remembers his dreams. He remembers, this is the moment that God had spoken to me about 21 years before. And watch how he handles it. Because there are going to be certain places in your life, and I don't want you to lose sight of this. The whole idea of this entire series is that I desire, and more so God desires, for the dreams that God has put within your life decades ago, that at some point they would find their destination. And I want you to remember that, and along the way, you will have opportunities to steward the dream in such a way that when you are in a position of power and authority, you leverage it for glory, not for your own gain. And Joseph has this incredible moment where he has to decide this. And he messes with him a little bit, but you'll see why. Everybody okay so far? Let's keep going. Verse 10. They then say back to him, no, we're not spies. He says that you're spies. You come to see the weaknesses in our land. No, we are servants, come to buy food. We're all sons of one man. We are honest men. Come on. You have to read the Bible in such a way that there is comedy that comes out. Because Joseph had to be like, say what? I remember you. You don't remember me. We're going to get to that, brothers. But I remember the fact you are not honest men. I remember the clanking of the shekels as I was sold to the Amalekites. You're not honest men. Your servants have never been spies. At least I got that part right. Keep going. Okay, the next part. Next slide, please. But Joseph said to them, oh, did I? You know what? I may have to go back to this. I'm messing up my rhythm. Did I skip anything, George? Okay, you're at 12? Okay, thank you. He said to them, that is, no, it's to see the, where we're exposed, where we're vulnerable is what you've come to see. They said, no, we are your servants, and we were 12 brothers. One is no more, and the youngest was with our father. Daddy wouldn't let him come. Keep going. But Joseph said, no, it is as I say to you, you are spies. By this you shall be tested. And it's a setup. He wants to test their heart and what they are about. Has any change happened within them? You shall not go on from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Keep going. Send one of you, let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words might be tested, whether there is truth in what you say. I'll pause there and I'll retell the rest of it this way. Watch this. So, help me out. Joseph is wanting to test them, right? There are 10 brothers. Where they are from is Canaan. Where they are is Egypt. Joseph is going to test them. He wants to see, has anything changed within their heart? So what does he say first? Help me for a second. What does he say? This is your first fill-in. The first option is send one and the remainder stay in custody. Everybody got that? So one's going to go back to Canaan. And then how many would stay in Egypt? 9. 9 would go. Then I'll retell the next part of this. He then allows them and himself to think about it for 3 days. During this time, he puts them into jail. How you like me now, right? I've been there a long time. At least you get 3 days. Joseph had a little smirky on that one. Puts them in. All of them, though, right now, they're all waiting. Nobody's gone back to Canaan yet. Everybody caught up on that? Okay. But his proposal, option one, is one would go back to dad, 9 would stay. Then he reverses it. And he actually says, because I fear God, here's what we're going to do. We're going to invert this. Now we're going to do, instead, now that I've had time to think about it, instead, here's what I want to do. I'm going to have 9 go to Canaan, and one will stay in Egypt. And here's why I think he does it specifically. There's other reasons, but here's the main reason. The last time he saw them, he was the one, and they all left him behind. Has anything changed? Because watch this. Think about this. Think about the flow of this. They're in this foreign land. They go back, and Joseph is trying to get the opportunity, not just to see his younger brother, Benjamin. That's a big part of it. But he is trying to test, has anything changed and moved within their hearts? Are y'all tracking me on this? Okay, so watch this. If one goes back, of course that one is going to come back for the 9. How would you explain that to dad otherwise? Like they tried to explain one 2 decades ago. That would be hard for the one to explain. Go, I don't know what happened. I'm the only one. Like that wouldn't have played. Joseph realizes this. What happens is he goes, no, all the rest of you go back. And let's see if dad will make an exchange, Benjamin, for the one. Because last time you had the opportunity, you failed. You actually exploited me on purpose. I'm looking out. The last thing I see is your faces as I'm going on a caravan to a foreign land. And this is the first time we're seeing each other since then. Everybody with me? This is significant because he's trying to test them on what needs to take place. Then the rest of it goes this way. So then the brothers, they get this word. Not only option one, not only option two, then they say to one another, this is because of what we did to our brother. Come on, here's what we got to camp out for a moment. There are certain places in our lives, our hearts condemn us. It's not God condemning you, because the scripture would say later on that Jesus didn't come into the world to condemn you, but to save you, to liberate you, to set you free. But when our hearts condemn us, it's guilt coming. And so you know what we do? We push it down as best as we can. We push away the guilt. But listen, if that's the first inclination more than two decades later, it was always on their heart that they knew anytime anything bad would happen, it's because of that. Come on, we're all people. If we blame other people, we blame God, we blame the world, the flesh, the devil. But here's what we know to be true about this. There are certain places definitively when bad things happen in our lives, we know it could be directly proportionate to we're going to get what's coming. What goes around comes around, and the reciprocal as well. Are you all tracking me so far, church? This is significant for us to understand because what the brothers begin to do is now, even though they don't know Joseph is actually the one that's there, he's privy to all of this, and he is able to see the fact that they're owning it. Then Joseph begins to unveil the test. There are certain places in your life and mine we need to own our own sin. We need to stop pushing it down. We need to understand that it's really more a spirit of conviction than a spirit of condemnation. And God is wanting to set us free to have a new start. And we need to welcome the test. Let me give you those fill-ins. Because here's the thing. It's very possible. And I want you to see yourself in the story as Joseph. I want you to keep dreaming. And we understand that God has put dreams within your heart and they're not done yet. And so that means God's not done yet. But I also think along the way, we need to see ourselves as the spirit of the brothers along the way too. And there's certain places that that might be. So let me illustrate it this way. Let's pretend that you're in a close relationship. Maybe you have a boyfriend, a fiance, spouse, brother, sister, close friendship. And let's say you've done that person wrong. What you have done is, this is a relatively clean board. Ingrid tried to clean it one more time. It's not working, is it? We're trying to clean it, but let's pretend it's entirely white. Can we all agree that it's a white board? Okay? Semi-white, off-white. Okay. What happens is every time we sin, we do our own brother thing, what happens is we mark up the white. How many of you, if I left that on there, you see it just as a white board or your eye goes to the mark, to the black? Remember the old stain commercial where the stain is talking? And that's all that. That's the same principle as what happens in our lives regarding sin. So what happens is we have put this onto somebody that's in our life. And here's what happens is then we have the sorry aspect. I'm sorry. Okay, so you're sorry. So that which you did, your patterns of being unaccountable, your patterns of being dishonest, that's going to change. Well, no, I'm just sorry that this happened. But not necessarily sorry enough that this side's going to be any different. I'm sorry that you feel that way. I'm sorry you're hurt. I'm sorry for all those things. And then we may even try to go back on something. Oh, this is a really big mark. Let me see if I can take care of that. That's a big mark. Let me try to take care of that. But meanwhile, the person that we've inflicted that upon, when they see us, they see the relationship, what do they see? It's this. And we can only go so far in the relationship because what happens is trust has been violated. Are y'all tracking me still? Trust isn't violated. And here's what we do. We then oftentimes we respond like an addict does because we really are all addicted to sin. We respond like an addict. And here's what we do. We go, no, but I drew a line in the sand. And like from here on, it's going to be different. Like you got me going to church today. And so like Sunday's going to be pure. And then Monday I'll be pure. It's going to be good. And so I don't want you to look over here, sweetie, best friend. Brother, I don't want you to look over here anymore because it's a new day. I've drawn a line. It's different now. It's a new day. And the person goes, no, but you don't have enough stackability on this side. I still see all this marked and our relationship and our trust is all marked up. Am I communicating? And so what happens is that's the way an addict talks. An addict speaks in such a way to go, I know it's been years of unfaithfulness, but look at the last 4 days. I got a good track record. Because when we are still, hear me, addicted to sin and addicted to our past, we want people to see the most recent rather than the collective nature of what has happened over and over and over again that has heaped hurt on the people that are around us. We want this because we want to feel better. But the people around us, they don't feel better. We have heaped all this. And a simple human sorry doesn't do it. It has to move that it's godly sorrow. And if it's sorry, we'll keep inflicting it and they have to deal with it. We put it on them. We project it onto them. Godly sorrow says, I will deal with my own sin and sin nature. And my desire is that over time, that as you see that we get further and faster away from this, that it becomes more in the rearview mirror and we keep dealing with it so that trust will come, but it takes a while. And that's what Joseph is trying to establish, is embrace the test. We need to see, has anything changed? Are you just sorry for what happened, or is it different for tomorrow? And you and I need to establish that in our own relationships. Otherwise, the same thing will happen over and over again. It creates chasms and a perimeter around our relationships that God never intended. I hope that makes sense to you. So own it and welcome the test. So then the rest of the flow goes this way. I'll keep retelling it rather than reading all of it. Reuben speaks up. Reuben speaks up in verse 22. You can put it up as I reference it, George. Verse 22, he begins to speak and he says, listen, let me tell you something. This is because of what we did. And you guys didn't listen to me then, and guess what? In this moment, they're also not going to listen to him again. He is the firstborn, and we'll pull on him later as to why they don't listen to him, but they totally disregard what he says, and they're still in the presence of Joseph. And verse 24 concludes with, they take Simeon, who was the thirdborn, into custody, and everybody else goes free. As they go, you have this, that they get loaded up in verse 25 with grain, silver, and provisions. As they go back and they see that they have been loaded up with all of this, they think, one sees it first, and in the presence of their dad, they see all the rest of it, that all the grain, the silver, and the goods have been all returned back to them. They think they look like thieves. You know why? Because their hearts are still condemning them. And anything that's taking place is still, their hearts are still condemning them. And so they turn to one another and they say, what is this that God has done to us? God wasn't doing it. It was, they were self-condemning. Because it was pulled to the surface. And now they had to make a decision. Do we push it back down again so that our conscience is seared? Do we push it back down again that we become apathetic and everybody else has to deal with it? Or do we let it rise so that we can deal with it, so that we can find freedom from yesterday and forgiveness for tomorrow? And you and I have the same type of decisions to make, because otherwise we'll never walk in the spirit of Joseph. We'll always be condemned to the spirit of the other brothers. And God is trying to deal with us on some of those things within our lives. So they retell the story back to Jacob. Dad, listen, we got to go back for grain at some point. But even before we do that, Benjamin's got to go back with us. And Jacob says this incredible statement. If you would put up verse 36 for me, George. Verse 36 says this. As they emptied their sacks, behold, every man's bundle was there. We already mentioned that. And then Jacob says, you have bereaved me of my children. Who's he speaking this to? Over? To the other brothers. To the other, right? To the kids. You have bereaved me of my children. Joseph is no more. Simeon is no more. And now you want me to take Benjamin? You want to take him with you? All this has come against me. And you know what? He's right. It all has come against him. And then he goes on to say this incredible statement in the next couple of verses. Reuben says, kill my sons if I don't bring them back. Keep going. Bring Simeon and Benjamin back. You can trust. But he said, my son shall not go down with you. This is Jacob speaking. For his brother is dead, for all that I know. That's what you guys have led me to believe, right? Joseph is dead. And he is the only one left. Who's he speaking of? Who's the only one left? Imagine the other brothers. What's he saying? You are just part of the story, but my heart is with Benjamin. And my heart's already broken, and you want to break it one more time? You're not who matters to me. I'm all in on the one. And Jacob still hasn't learned his lesson regarding the preferential treatment. All this has come against me. There are certain places in your life and mine we need to deal with some of the things that are amiss within our lives. They're not merely mistakes or mishaps. They're sins against God and against the people that we live with. I'm going to ask you to stand with me, and let me close with this as the worship team comes to help. This passage took me in an entirely different place than I had intended as I began to prepare it the last couple of weeks. And I believe it's for this reason. There are certain places in our lives that we will never walk in what God wants in our dreams if we don't truly resolve the yesterdays. And too often we try to resolve the yesterdays of the things that have happened to us. But how about some of the things that we have done? How about some of the things that we have caused some pain? How about some of the places where we need to take ownership and embrace the test that we have violated and eroded trust around us? And those relationships are so paramount that we need to make it right. Let me give you a cautionary tale as we move to respond this morning. I believe this is now going to be the most important part of our service together. As we respond, that we shift from being hearers to doers of His Word. But there are certain places in our lives where we know we have hurt someone. You and I need to do two things. One, we need to confess it to God, because only God can truly and ultimately forgive us. And secondly, in the people's lives that you know you have hurt them. Now listen, if you have certain things like ill will, or you know, you've had wrong thoughts about somebody else's wife, like you don't need to confess those things to those people, because watch this, you'll feel better and they'll feel worse. Are you all with me? Did I lose you on that? But if you know you've caused pain in certain areas to that person and has been a wedge, that person is not the same now because of your pain inflicted towards them. You need to make it right. You start with God, and He'll even show you how to do it right. So it'll be received. That you have the opportunity to see trust come back again, especially in the most paramount of relationships. But too often, we tell the wrong people. We tell people that don't have anything to do with it, and we're getting counsel. We're getting advice. And all we're doing is we're feeling better temporarily, but we're not freed for tomorrow. So there are certain things that you need to treasure and use wisdom on who to communicate it to, how to communicate it, because there are certain people that are privy to some of the things that you have done, and you need to make it right. And others, it's unbeknownst to them, don't stir it up because you go, oh, I feel so much better, I told you that. And you just dumped hot coals in their lap. Are you with me? I feel like I lost you. We need to start with confessing to God. And when you know there has been hurt and pain, and that person's now glazed over, they have removed themselves, they're angry, and it's because of you, it's because of me, you got to make it right. And all this story is this incredible setup that Joseph's going to have the opportunity to really see whether these guys have changed. And at one point, he's going to speak over their lives. What you intended for harm, God allowed, intended for the saving of many lives. Even through your imposed, intended pain, God can redeem it. God can redeem it and redeem the time. So it's important now, we're in a house that's been constructed for the worship and the glory of God. Now let's go confess our sin to our God. Because more than likely, we have tried to excuse certain things away on the whiteboard of our lives. And all we see, what God sees and some people around us see, are all the black marks that need to be redeemed, they need to be forgiven, and it starts with confession. Are you with me? And then I want you to think, as you confess it to God, if there are people that you know that you have hurt them, you need to go make it right. You need to go make it right. So let me give you an example of what not to do as we close. There was somebody that had hurt me a long time ago, and he had no idea. How many of you have situations like that? They have no idea. They had no idea. And I wasn't going to go back to that person and say something. I had ill will in my heart towards that person now. They had no idea what was going on. They didn't know how they'd hurt me. They had no idea the ill will towards them. But I wasn't like plotting his death or anything. Don't get scared. But it was unhealthy in my heart what I was harboring. But I knew he was none the wiser, so there was no need to communicate it. Once God set me free of it, I didn't need to communicate it to him. Then I made myself accountable with somebody else so that it wouldn't come back into my heart as something that was unhealthy. There are times we rush to try to make it right with other people because it makes us feel better. That doesn't mean that the sin is no longer going to resurface. You and I need to come up with what God wants to do as a heavenly strategy so that the old is the old and behold, He is making all things new. That's what God wants to establish in your life. So let's begin to transition. I dare you to sing this song that's entitled Here in Your Presence. Sing this song as a prayer. And as you do, I invite you to come a little bit closer. Now is our time to enter into our relationship with God, so that coming out of here, we have a strategy how to relate to other people. deal with what God is wanting you to deal with right now. And He is not wanting to condemn you. He is wanting to liberate you. He is not wanting you to be dead in your shame. He's wanting to save you this morning. He is wanting His freedom, His life and His love to be over you. And only He can do it. Now is your time to be set free and to be forgiven so that tomorrow will look radically different than yesterday. Come on, let's respond. I dare you all to come as close as you can to symbolize that, behold, He is making all things new. Let's go.